Hello, and welcome to Pear Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wabo's most popular work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
But wait, Elliot, before we get into the episode, first a quick reminder for everybody out there that the fan art contest with the theme of siblings is currently running. So keep your fan arts coming by the end of the month and get them over to us.
Yep, I think it's like 2 weeks till submissions closed, so
yeah.
Drawing, painting, sculpting, etc.
Etc. Also, the Discord is public, so if you want to join the Doof Discord and discuss your work as it's going together, discuss your piece, you can do so by going to doofmedia.com/discord. It's totally free, anyone can do it, and everybody should.
Yeah.
All right, and with that, let's talk about false moves, 12.4 and 12.5. We'll start with 12.4. I think, well, should we mix it up? No, let's start with 12.4. We're in Vrona's head, and it starts with her falling asleep, very literally, grouping up with the Kenneteers to speak to Sig.
Yeah, Ruben, would you say she's hit rock bottom?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Well played. Oh, let me join in. Yep.
No, wait, for real, it's really fun how, obviously, we're kind of leading up to the confrontation with Charles in this week's chapters, and we really open with, like, this big thing of, like, how shitty Verona's life is, just, like, over, like, a mild gainsaying.
Mm.
Like, she's kind of already hitting a wall. The chapter literally opens with, like, her going on a spiel about, like, oh, God, even when we're asleep, we're working, which I assume, like, especially based on later stuff in this world, doesn't count. Like, you know, they don't get rest while they're in these nightmares.
Yeah, you would assume so, wouldn't you?
So it's just like we sort of open with like Verona is just really struggling and literally hits rock bottom like as she enters this dream. Like it's really sort of setting up this gainsaying is bad, and I couldn't just help but be like, remember, this is Charles's life all the time, probably worse.
Yeah, that's a fun thing to be thinking about as we head into our inevitable confrontation with Charles, just remembering this is what he, you know, this is how he lives his life every single day.
Yeah, it's a classic Wabo 2-for-1 special where it's like it's preparing us for Charles, whereas also it's like helping set up just sort of where Verona's at right now. And I really love the way when she tries to use glamour as she's falling, it's like centipedes that attack her hand and prevent her from doing that, which is like super clear imagery that's the aurum.
Yeah.
Which I like because usually like we've talked about like the karma and shit that Charles has, and it's all a little bit like, you know, it's subtle. It's never like on the surface. It's always subtext.
Mm.
And that makes it like a little bit hard to be like concretely, this is the gainsaying. This is, like, you know, bad karma or whatever. Whereas with this thing here, thanks to the dream space, we get a very clear signal that, like, Wabo's saying, this is the gainsaying. Verona's having a bad time because of the gainsaying.
Mm.
Whereas, like, I usually it's a bit more between the lines. I kind of like that it's very explicit here.
Explicitly why Verona is suffering here, for sure. So yeah, I think the kind of vibe of this chapter is very fun as well. Obviously, we'll get into the bar in a moment, but the vibe I saw other people on Reddit calling it this noir detective vibe, and I quite like that. I mean, it's black and white, obviously, which is helping to set that mood. Things like how at the start of this chapter we don't really know actually who they're going to see, right? It's a bit of a mystery. Even the Kenneteers don't know until they start to smell cigarettes, basically. It's just kind of more like detective-y if they get to kind of figure it out and get all these hints from the environment and stuff like that. It's just kind of a fun vibe of the chapter.
Yeah, and you're right. Like, it's a cool use of the premise because we're in a space where everything is coming from the person whose dream we're in. So it's like everything is kind of telling us something about them. And so like what a great entry point then to just throw us in someone where we don't know who it is. And so we're kind of using those bits and pieces to put it together.
Mm.
And I noticed we haven't talked about Goop Face Verona. So I just want to call that out. I just how like the way she kind of resists changing from it, I just to kind of annoy Avery and Lucy is almost the vibe I get, is very fun.
I don't know. Verona's gross kind of aesthetics in this chapter, I wasn't a huge fan of them. I was kind of more on the side of the other Kenneteers, where I was like, yeah, cool, that's cool, Verona, but I'm not like, it's a bit off-putting.
I loved it. I do, like, you're right though, like she does eventually, to quote Lucy, change, which makes it sound like she changed clothes and not her face. But I love how she like just immediately leans into the aesthetic of the dream. Like she's dressed herself up in like a, you know, black dress, and I think she's wearing like lots of jewelry, and she starts like drinking whiskey. Like she very much just naturally tries on any new aesthetic like this in a really fun way.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like, it comes to me back to the idea of like Verona being unhappy in her regular skin means that she'll lean into things that can be sometimes kind of damaging, e.g. literally she's ready to start smoking cigarettes at the drop of the hat, and she's remarking through this chapter on like, yeah, I kind of like this. I could see myself acquiring this taste. And I was like, Verona, no, don't do this.
Yeah, well, because like, as you mentioned before, like Avery, there's this moment where like Verona, as soon as she sort of realizes she can be whoever she wants, she's instantly like, why would I be myself?
Mm.
And Avery and Lucy are very much immediately like, I like my identity. And then they're quickly like, we like your identity too, by the way.
Mm.
Which is very much like sending this clear signal of like, they see it as Verona running away from who she is, which I don't know. I think there's arguments for and against that. We'll get into it more later, I suppose. But she definitely has mentioned things like feeling like her dad broke her. But it's kind of, I don't know, to me, it's like regardless of why she wants to change, this feels like the place or, you know, the environment to fuck around and figure it out, you know? Like, smoking cigarettes here is better than trying them out in real life, especially with the Melissa dream in the back of our heads.
Yes, true. But the better option would be to not want to do that regardless, right? Like, yeah. Yes, you're right. But the fact that she's like kind of willing to let herself slip into that identity is the slightly worrying thing.
Yeah, I guess it comes down to how much of that is going to really boil down to like Verona's, like the effects from her dad and like what he's done to her self-confidence, self-identity, like worldview and all of that, versus just how much of it is just her marching to the beat of a different drum.
Mm.
Like, I don't know. I feel like to some degree, it's just naturally Verona to be the sort of person who would just walk into this dream, change herself into like, you know, a well-dressed member of the party and try out whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I don't know. It's interesting because I agree. There's definitely part of it that is like coming from her dad and the damage he's done to her. But I think part of it is just intrinsically her.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why, to me, it's all a matter of degrees. And that's kind of why I would support trying stuff out in the dream.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Like, obviously, it's a safe place to kind of experiment with that stuff and remove some of the like stigma from it that would make it a bit enticing. Yeah. I totally get that. But
no, but you're right. The fact that it's just like immediately cigarettes and alcohol is a little bit like,
yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's not the direction ironically, it'd probably be like fairy stuff that I'd be more like, yeah, let's, you know, play around with that a bit.
That didn't go so well either. So anyway, the trio are searching for this, for Sig in this bar, but aren't able to find him despite all the drinking and smoking. But Lucy, the eavesdropper, quickly realizes that speaking to Sig here might require some eavesdropping.
This is so good. Like, this
isn't
perfect.
It great? It's so good. It's the whole thing of like, because obviously when we were in Sig's head, or you know, when we had Sig's interlude, we saw Sig's basically whole deal was going around and just picking up bits of and pieces and snippets of conversations and interactions. So it's such a perfect extension of that's the way that Sig interacts. It's just wonderful.
Yeah, like it feels like such a natural other side of that perspective we saw in 10.B. Like we saw how his prose and his personality, so much as one exists, changed a bit when he was around different people. And you sort of get that vibe now, except he kind of turns it on them in a fun way. Like it's, it's just a really cool example of how, like, not just perfect to the, like, underlying tenets of the Otherverse are that this sort of scene is created, but also how good Wabo is at implementing them. Like, he thought of this, because this is one of the many, many times reading an Otherverse thing I've been like, when you see it, you're like, oh, that's perfect, and that makes total sense. But I never would have put it together myself, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. I mean, that's what Wabo is so good at, is taking these things that make perfect sense in hindsight, but still feel like they're surprises.
Yeah.
It kind of made me a bit sad for Sig, though. Like, yeah. Some of these snippets... So the one I've pulled out specifically is there's these two women talking, clearly kind of a new relationship, and one of them is confiding in the other of, like, a past relationship that they had with a woman that was clearly toxic for them, right?
Yeah.
But that's all kind of the subtext to the text that Sig is saying here, which is, you know, oh, Edith was someone that I kind of felt at home with, so... And it seemed fine, so I just kind of went along with it, right?
Yeah.
But it's just like these snippets seem to have such emotional depth for the people that they originally came from. I'm kind of assuming that the way Sig is communicating here is effectively repeating conversations that he has been overheard previously, right? And it just feels like it makes Sig feel so alien, I suppose, because it's just this kind of like straight repetition of words which had so much emotional weight and subtext to them when they were first spoken, but now are being said just kind of bluntly by Sig as the only way Sig can communicate. It's I don't know, it just feels like alien and sad.
Yeah, well, it's almost like he gets to experience emotions, but not his.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, the real tragedy for me is the moment, I think it's, like, right after that, where they're sort of like, can you promise you won't fall in with a bad crowd again? He's basically like, no. Like, yeah. He takes so much from the people he's around. He's almost like, I mean, wait, that was so much more textual with Liz, but, like, really getting to talk to Sig, I see how he's very much, like, even more than Liz, somebody who's built from the people he's surrounded by, and, like, he doesn't get to have his own emotions or his own set of ideals. He just sort of has to take them from whoever he's around at the time. And that, like, God.
Mm.
Like, yeah. That one line he has where they're sort of like, do you have ideals? And he's like, he says something along the lines of like, not really, but I understand the sentiment.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But yeah, it's kind of brutal to think about. Like, the poor guy has very little self-control, I guess, because his self is very malleable.
Mm. Yeah.
But just to touch on like all this whole area, like I love this this whole sort of premise of like Sig has to talk in what I assume are like not necessarily conversations he's overheard, but it's like it has to be the framing of like a conversation two people in this bar situation would be likely to have.
Mm.
Like it's a bit of a fun twist on the Echo they interviewed in Arc 2. Where it's like, or actually, it also just like talking to Monty when he's in the radio. Like it's, you can't talk to them directly, but we get this really fun device of conversations that are semi-related, and you have to put those puzzle pieces together. It's just like, you know, we've done a few variations of it now, and it's still really fun.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Yeah. One of my favorites is when Sig is talking about Charles and we overhear a joke teller say, now, our guy, we're not 100% sure, but if anyone around here is going to get caught in a compromising position with a pretty dog like that, and that's all we hear. And it's just so perfect. I thought that was wonderful.
Yeah. It's a really good job by Sig at like pulling out a reasonable bar conversation that absolutely nails Charles's situation.
Yeah, it's great. So yeah, Sig does give us some useful information. The new goblins are, or at least were, involved somehow, as well as Guillemet was the one who called in the witch hunter.
Not the goblins.
Yeah, I know. But it's the new ones that we don't like as much, so it's
no, fine. One of them's Ram Jam.
Yeah, I guess.
I agree. A lot of the other ones, like Creamfield and Kitty Cough, like, yeah.
Blunt Munch is mentioned as well, though, which is worrying. Great Club Muncher Bunch.
Yeah, it's a bit interesting with him, though, because he's more mentioned, like, it's sort of like, oh, the ones Blunt Munch brought in, like, yeah. XYZ.
Yeah.
And it's a little unclear whether their Blunt is included.
Yeah, but we've kind of been suspicious of Blunt for a while, right? But is that right, or was it Gashwood? I can't remember now.
No, it was...
It was Blunt, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was usually Blunt. It was sort of like, if a goblin has to be involved, it would probably be Blunt.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I can't believe that they were any more on top of shit than fucking Charles is going to... I'm still on team. Charles is mostly a stooge.
Mm.
Biscuit's one of the other ones.
Mm.
Biscuit's, you know, I liked Biscuit. She was the one who was trying to get the Barney.
Yeah, wanted to recruit
Melissa.
Any goblin, we're going to have some emotional connection to them because they're all so wonderful.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, it'll be very interesting to chase this thread up and see how involved any and all goblins were.
Yeah,
especially it'll be funny if Blunt was secretly getting them involved in the conspiracy, just because in 5.D we had Toad Swallow hire Peckersnot and like put extra conditions on him.
Mm.
And it just like a great little plot device for Wabo, make it so sus of Toad Swallow at the time. Would really like Blunt was presumably walking around to the other ones recruiting them for the actual conspiracy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun that Toad isn't implicated in this conspiracy, but the other one that he's got going on. We get the Kentis now know about the Gillamay reveal, which is fun. It seems we're gonna get some kind of answer on what the hell Gillamay's up to.
this is like really a Lucy moment, so we're not gonna deal with it right now because it's like really she's the one with the biggest relationship with Gillamay, she's the one who gets hit by it. It's gonna be very fun to see how he tries to justify it and how much the Kennetiers are probably not going to go for that.
Mm.
Because we got told by that fortune teller in Arc 8 that, you know, the Kennetiers wouldn't like who he's becoming, and I think we're going to finally start to see that manifesting.
Mm. Yeah, I think so. Although, I don't know, like, this calling in the Witch Hunter thing was before he really started falling to winter, right? Like,
oh, I mean, it's only like,
I guess it hasn't been that long, has it?
It's like a week and a half ago.
Yeah, true. I don't know. I just, unless he's been falling to winter, some of these signals that have been more overt have only been more recent as well, right? Like,
yeah. I guess if you compare it to like just like a lot of things that develop with age, like I'm thinking like, you know, some forms of dementia and stuff.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
it is a bit inconsistent like that, you know, like, so like, who knows? Like, because, you know, I'm still kind of writing the theory that he's also the one who got Estrella's family killed.
Mm.
So it could have just been one of those things where, you know, this was a thing he had done in the past. And so just like came more easily to him as he was falling to winter. And yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess we'll have to see. You're right. It could be kind of more gradual.
I also want to just say, like, as we get to the end of this, like, interview segment, how fun it was, like, towards the end, we sort of see Verona finally notice how, like, each of the Kenneteers is kind of struggling with interviewing Sig for their own reasons. And it was just one of those moments where I love how perfectly characterized these three are. Like, Lucy is clearly struggling with the like indirectness of this conversation. Like, she really hates just not getting straight answers.
Mm.
Whereas Avery's like eyes are darting around, and Verona notes like Avery's really struggling with the idea that she can't like make eye contact with and just focus on the other member of the conversation.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah, so perfectly Avery. And then meanwhile, Verona sort of starts to realize she's struggling with paying enough attention because she's getting distracted by the whiskey and like the cool dress.
And she, oh, like, Verona.
She like realizes the other two are struggling and steps up. But I just sort of loved that moment of like realizing that all three of them are struggling in such distinctly them ways. Like, mm-hmm. The characterization in this book's so good.
Yeah. It is great, isn't it? It's such a wonderful scene for all these different reasons. So with some info from Sig, they head back to the real world, and Verona's going a bit stir crazy. So she reaches out to Nicolette for something, anything to do.
It's like, yeah, you know things are bad when Verona's looking for, like, boring grunt work.
Yeah, it's rough. So, yeah, I like Nicolette mentions that Alexander Gaines said her once every 2 weeks, give or take, which is just as the murder of Alexander is about to get relitigated. It's nice to just remember how much of a piece of shit Alexander was.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic point. And especially as we, as another step, as we're rebringing in all the Blue Heron Institute people, just a reminder that that was just totally acceptable behavior there.
Yep.
To just, for an adult man to gainsay, like, his teenage ward and make her sick for a tiny bit of power. Cool, guys.
Yeah. Thumbs up.
On the Charles reappearance countdown, Seth also gets a throwaway mention here, which just stood out to me because Nicolette sort of, like, it goes and she's like, yeah, I'm really looking for someone to do this grunt work, and I can't because Seth is completely useless.
Mm.
And I was just like, that's got to be the karma talking, because, like, the poor dude, like, it's so harsh to just be like, this guy who's been forsworn is so useless. Like,
he's been forsworn so hard he can't even do paperwork.
Well, and just like, you know, maybe she meant he's too much of an emotional mess, but it's like, well, like, you know, a little bout with depression in his current circumstances seems warranted.
Mm.
And like just calling him useless doesn't feel like it's really helping. He was being a dickhead to her, like, I remember, after all. So, like, he could just still kind of be being a cunt, but yeah.
Could be. Yeah. I don't know. I wonder if we'll see him again and just see what he's like now. I don't have high hopes.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, I wonder if he'll have turned around like Charles did, but, well, that's looking a little bit shaky, so.
True.
I don't know. Seth feels like just such a natural way to sort of compare what happened to Charles. I'll be interested to see how they both turn out and have turned out as we get the deets on Charles.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting that Verona is so desperate to... so desperate to do anything magical that she will sign up to be an unpaid secretary.
Yeah, there's all sorts of justifications she comes up with, like, oh, we owe you one. I don't know. I sometimes find, like, mindless work like this super cathartic. So, like, Verona says, I think later in the chapter, she got like 150 pages or something done of it at one point. So, like, she must have clearly been able to enter the zone, so that's nice.
Yeah, that is quite nice. Verona's dad arrives with the protective services in tow, and he announces that she's moving back in with him, and he seemed to have threatened Jasmine.
Mm-hmm.
Psych! They're actually in a nightmare and off to chat to Nibble and Chloe. so mean! It was the worst!
Oh, fuck, this got me good.
Yeah, it got me too. I was starting to freak out before the reveal, and then I was like, oh, yeah, okay, great. Thanks, Walpo.
I love it as well, because it's not like... It doesn't feel like one of those, like, bad kind of cheap dream fake-outs that, you know, like, so many TV show episodes open with or whatever. Like, because dreams have been in this chapter. Like, what I love about it is this is two-thirds of the way in after we've been in another dream sequence. So it's like, it's not at all coming out of nowhere. This is absolutely like, the sign was there. There's like a weird segment break. Like, you know, it's not like the bad kind of cheap. It's just like Wobbo fucking with us in a way that, like, feels yeah. very on topic.
Yes. No, it was great. it was great. But yeah, it was a cruel prank.
I was so angry and also relieved. I think that's what's really fun about it is it's like as angering as it is relieving when you find out it's fake. So you just kind of left there just feeling grumpy and you're not 100% sure exactly at who and how much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, let's get into this interview, shall we? Because it's with Nibble and Chloe, and they're so wonderful again. Like, Nibble is so awkward about what he wants to say here, which is basically like, hey, if things become untenable for me and Chloe, we might have to leave, which is just like the most reasonable thing. And he's saying it like it's some big reveal. They're so delightful.
Yeah, like, I remember when they were first introduced and we were like talking about like the concern with these two is that as things get worse, things get better for them. So whose side will they be on? Like,
yeah, you know,
there was like worry that they might change sides. And it's so good that they've turned out to be so wholesome that they're basically at the point where they like walk up and they say, hey, like, we don't want to change sides. And if it's actually bad, we won't. But
yeah,
like, full disclosure, if they've got pretty good reasons and this is better for us, like,
yeah, we might.
Yeah, we might. And we'll tell you. Like, it's so chill and mature and upfront. I was just like, holy shit. Like, if you're going to get betrayed, these are the people you want doing it.
Yeah. They're so wonderful.
Yeah. Like, no, it's honestly more relieving from a sense of worrying about their betrayal that they're just going to be like, hey, I guess we might if it's like the better path for us. You can't really argue with that. Like, it takes away any of the secrecy or doubt.
Yeah, it's great. I like honesty in this story. It always feels nice and refreshing.
There's also just like great banter between Nibble and Chloe. I really love this moment where they talk about being together for sort of centuries, and they, you know, they're planning like their big epic fights as well as like getting married. And there's even a bit where they talk about how they're not going to be together forever, and Avery, of course, is like, what? Of course you'll be together forever. And like, Nibbles is just sort of like, no, I'm more realistic than that. And
yeah,
like, just a nice, like, obviously this is, you know, part of Avery's journey from the start of the story has been her unrealistic relationship expectations. And I don't just mean relationship as in romantic ones, I mean like general. And so, like, I think it's just nice for her to hear from cool, upfront people like this, just like, our relationship can still be super precious without needing to have to be something that goes forever.
Yeah, it is nice. It gives the sense of, like, Nibble and Chloe having lived so long that they're kind of a past bullshit, you know?
Yeah, and it's bullshit Avery specifically has needed to get past this whole story, so just... you know, bits like this chipping away at how she thinks about this stuff. I'm all aboard.
Hey, yeah. Also worth noting, Alpi is kind of not having a good time here. Like, one, the dream organizing stuff is clearly taking a toll on her. Two, her best friend was just kind of revealed to be one of the villains.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, like, yeah, Avery realizes this and kind of tries to be a bit nicer later, but, the Kentiers are really demanding a lot from her, and Verona, at least in this chapter, does not seem very grateful. I just kind of feel like they're maybe mistreating her a bit.
I tend to agree. I do think Alpi has put herself in a bit of a girl who cried wolf situation with this, because she has been whining about work since day one. Like, I'm not going to lie, I kind of glossed over it my first read-through, just like Verona did. And then when you hit all the stuff about, like, Marisica and all that, I was like, oh, shit, of course she's taking it hard. And on my second read, I was a little bit more sympathetic. But, like, yeah, I don't know. Like, part of me is like, you know, Alpi, you got to stop whinging about work all the time so that when it's actually hard, you can, like, hit that note.
You're right. Maybe she's a bit of a girl who cried wolf situation, but I just, Verona especially, I was just kind of like, Verona, she's doing you so many favors, like, chill out a bit.
Yeah, no, you're right. Like, Avery seems to be the only one who sort of picks up and is like, yeah, thank you. Anyway, Chloe is very explicitly telling them to be nicer to her. I mean, also, Alpi lost points for me. There's this moment where, to paraphrase, she says, like, basically, there's this kid that she needs to give nightmares to, and he's gone to a sleep clinic where she can't reach him. And basically, Avery's like, well, maybe that's a good thing, because maybe the sleep clinic will help him realize why he can't sleep, and he'll, like, confess, and you know, the guilt won't keep eating him up. And Alpiana's just sort of like, you know, what good does that do me? Like, that doesn't help me. And it just, like, you know, this was what we talked about with Alpi and Art too. Like,
yeah,
she, the point of her, like, she's just doing out punishments. She's not really looking to rehabilitate in any way.
Mm.
And this is the whole problem with, like, the system that she's a slave to is it would be nicer if it was aimed at actually helping people.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Like, feelings about Alpi, she feels almost the most stuck in her role of any of these Kenneteers. And she seems kind of nice, but just like she's perpetuating a bad system. There's not really anything that she can do about it, though, but she still is doing it.
Yeah, you're right. She's just stuck. And that's the thing. She's always kind of felt like someone who, like, you know, isn't really going to help when the time comes if it goes against, like, her nature, which kind of sucks.
Mm.
Like, I don't know how much you can necessarily count on her when push comes to shove. I mean, obviously, she'll do stuff for them here. Like, she's not totally selfish or unreliable, but, yeah, she's the most the slave to the system. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, after they get back from this chat with Nibble and Chloe, Lucy heads off on her date and Vrenna chit-chats with Jeremy, about to fall asleep before Nicolette sends in a message. People are being told about Alexander's death and more questions are coming.
I'm so excited by this.
Mm.
I think we, like, guessed that one of the birds would be going out to someone at Blue Heron.
Yeah.
To talk about this, and
here it is.
And, like, obviously, like, the witch hunters are still presumably around. Can't wait.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, it's going to be wild, I think. I mean, like, it seems like Radical Ray is going to try and smooth things over a bit, but I don't know if that's going to be able to happen.
Yeah. He's someone I'm not sure how much we should count on him to be an ally.
Yes. Yeah. You know, no, like, that's true.
He was pretty good by the end of the Blue Heron stuff, but, like, it's a bit of a bumpy road to get there, you know?
Mm.
He's someone who will still probably value overall stability.
Mm.
I don't know. Or maybe not. Like, yeah, I don't know. He seemed like in the process of maybe becoming a bit better than that. But, like, we'll see where he's at now if he comes. Hopefully he brings Zed and Nicolette because they can push him in the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. We'll have to see. Again, who knows what the fuck could happen? Like, it could get smoothed over nicely. Things could go really shit. We could get a showdown with, you know, the people like America Ted, for example, who were pro Alexander.
Yeah. Oh god, I hadn't even thought of America. Although she kind of got that out of her system a bit already.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Estrella's still the interesting one who I'm like I'm interested to see how she'll come into it. The Kenneteers have flirted with bringing her in. She was very pro Bristow.
Mm.
And then also, obviously, yeah, all the interplay with her and Guillaume, like, it just feels like she's set up to be some sort of, like, cog in the machine.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I don't know what to expect. It's a bit worrying.
And I think, like, before we move on from this section as well, we should talk about, like, Verona and Jeremy.
Mm.
Just because I feel like that was the topic that really blew up on our Discord, at least after our last episode.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's sort of three separate issues that all sort of came in. I think, like, a lot of us were, like, talking past each other because it's three sort of things and people were talking about different ones. Like, the big one is sort of, at least on our Discord, was Lucy and Avery and everyone else's, like, acceptance of Verona not wanting a classic romantic relationship.
Mm.
And I think Lucy does a pretty good job next chapter. Like, I'm jumping ahead a bit, but, like, Emerson brings up Jeremy and Verona and Lucy sort of shuts it down and is like, no, they're figuring it out and we should just let them and, like, maybe give them some nudges if they need it, which felt like a pretty good policy to me.
Yeah. No, I think so as well. Let them have their own space to kind of figure it out and, you know, see how they go.
Yeah. But, like, Verona expresses a little bit of frustration at Lucy in this part because Lucy doesn't seem to get, like, what she's going for with Jeremy.
Mm.
And I guess, like, I've seen a lot of other people share that frustration, and I think it's fair for Verona to be a little annoyed about it, but, like, it just feels unfair to me for us to judge Lucy at all for not getting it when I don't feel like she has any reason to have really understood the importance or the nuances of it. Because there's no role models or anything for them in this regard. And I think Verona's bad at explaining it. And I don't blame Verona for that, because Verona's bad at explaining it because she has no context or role models to like base it from. Like, you know, we saw that klutzy comparison she made to Avery sort of last chapter, which was like, you know, not a very good one, but the best that she could come up with in that situation. Like, it just feels hard to blame Lucy or Avery or anyone else for not getting it when it doesn't, I don't see in this context why they would have understood the importance.
Yeah, I think so.
Verona, I think, does a better job getting it through to Jasmine in this section than she has ever before, where she tells Jasmine, I'm getting a little bit pissed at Lucy for not getting this. And it's like, I don't think she said anything that clear or direct to Lucy on this topic.
Yeah, it definitely feels that way. I guess I feel like Verona is starting to figure out her own opinions on this just because they're being challenged a bit more by, you know, Lucy and Jeremy. Like, she kind of let herself slip into something, and only when it's starting to be questioned a bit is she actually, you know, figuring out actually where what she wants and what that looks like. And she's still at the stage of figuring that out internally, and then soon she will hopefully start, you know, making that external to people like Lucy.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it would be better if she had people like Lucy or Avery or, you know, maybe hopefully Jasmine to talk this out with, because I do, like, agree that it sucks that she doesn't really have anyone to talk it out with. But yeah, I can't extend that sort of frustration to Lucy and Avery for not getting it, because I don't see why they would understand it in the situation they're in.
Yeah,
hopefully Jazz is going to help fix that. I also think, just to be a bit harsh on Verona, because I'm channeling judgments on my own behavior in my past here, Verona has definitely shot herself in the foot by constantly teasing them about their relationships. Like,
yeah, totally.
She's trapped herself in a cycle here. Maybe Jasmine will help her break out of that. But, like, yeah, like, I think my big criticism of Verona, which was maybe getting a bit confused, so I just want to say, the only thing I feel like Verona is doing wrong here is I wish she would communicate with Jeremy more. Mm. Like, they have these texts here, and it's just so obvious Jeremy's on a different wavelength to her, and she says it, she knows it, and I feel like she's just avoiding confronting it.
Yeah.
And I can't support that, because it never ends well.
No, I agree. I think we're in agreement on this.
It's just interesting, because, like, the wrinkle in all this, like, the reason you got to really feel for Verona is, like, she's trying to figure this stuff out, and she clearly doesn't have, like, classical romantic tendencies.
Mm.
And, like, underlying all this, she's expressed a number of times this impression she has that her dad maybe broke her.
Mm.
And, like, so I feel like the messiness for her from this is, like, she's probably trying to understand how much of this is just, like, her and who she is versus how much is, like, damage her dad did to her, which is, like, shitty. And, yeah, like,
100%.
Not fair, and just, like, yeah, like, and I feel like that is probably a huge part of the problem she's having communicating all this stuff, is she's probably got doubts about how much of it is fair for her to feel or not feel.
I mean, it's all growth experiences, right? Like, I think we can be harsh on Verona, but I think we are in support of the fact that she is having these experiences, because they are opportunities for her to grow in these aspects that she hasn't had the home life to be able to experience in the past, you know, year or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, what's the point of having a boyfriend or whatever you want to call Jeremy at this age, except to figure shit out and fuck it up?
Yeah, exactly. Like,
which I think has been said by this story before.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. No, I'm mostly just, like, yelling at her when she, like, doesn't act on feelings she's feeling, just because I'm absolutely yelling at my past self before. Like, you know, I've been in relationships that should have ended a lot sooner than they did, because nobody in the relationship wanted to confront the problem.
Mm.
And so now I'm just, you know, taking that out on my past self by yelling at Verona.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder who, like, I'm trying to think if there is anyone in the story that Verona could use as a better, like, not necessarily role model, but, like, example of what she's talking about. Like, I don't know. I think like Auntie Heather, do we know what her relationship situation was?
Yeah, I don't think we do.
Just because she always, I remember when she was in the story, she was very much, we were like, we got to, like, you know, get her and Verona to hang out. They seem like on the same wavelength.
Mm.
Maybe someone like Auntie Heather will get Verona better than, like, even Jasmine might.
Yeah, 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 maybe. I don't know. I guess we don't. We Aunt Heather left such a strong impression for someone that was in one chapter. yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's everything I could possibly have to say on Verona and her relationship and everyone else's involvement in it.
Yeah. 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 Fair enough. Should we move on to 12.5?
Let's do it. Onto a different relationship.
Yeah, different lens through which to analyze 13-year-olds dating. So we're in Lucy's perspective here. Lucy is going on her date. First stop, the awkward drive with the parent in the car. A classic.
I do want to just quickly open with a shout out to Mia's mom, who absolutely knew what she was doing and was just shit stirring Mia, and I'm all for it. Like, there's no way she didn't know that every conversation, every like word she said was going to annoy Mia, and she was doing it anyway.
Mm.
That is absolutely the energy I would want to bring to parenting.
Yeah, yeah. This mother, Mia's mother, is doing pretty good as a chaperone. She's doing solid. In fact, Mia, let's just get this out there right now. Mia and Amadeus both are, I think, are pretty chill. They seem like pretty great.
Yeah, Mia's like pretty solid. Amadeus was just kind of like almost a background figure to me. Like, I don't think he ever expressed like a strong opinion on anything, except maybe one time getting a little bit peeved at Emerson. But you know,
who among us hasn't?
To go back to like just like the opening of this chapter, we sort of immediately open it with Lucy being like, you know, everyone's watching, or you know, it's like I'm being watched, which is just very much like, obviously he's having a bit of fun because, you know, in this story for half a second you think, oh god, like are there monsters, like there's been so much paranoia about being watched with the anti-augury stuff for the past arc and a half that you sort of are like, oh shit, is there like, you know, about to be an other attack? It's like, no, she's just going on a date.
Mm.
But also like it immediately also helps pull us in this headspace of like Lucy being watched and being judged has been so tied into the racism she's experienced. And that's obviously a driving force in the pressure she feels for this whole date. And I feel like that's a really good first line for just sort of instantly putting us back on that wavelength of being like, oh, you know, shit, everyone's out to get Lucy, or at least that's, you know, how she has to perceive it.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. The fact that Lucy is so self-conscious in this date and it is manifesting as her, you know, being hyper aware of everything, I guess, and kind of looking at everything through this lens and trying to kind of analyze every comment that the other five kids on this date make through a "are they being racist" lens.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems exhausting.
Yeah.
You feel bad for it, don't you?
It's one of those like aspects of like oppression or like, you know, as someone who hasn't really ever had to deal with this in that way, it's one of those more invisible sides to racism and oppression that I just wouldn't have thought about. And like, this is the sort of thing this story is making me a lot better at thinking about is just, I wouldn't have necessarily thought that Lucy would have to carry this so heavily on a date like this.
Mm.
But like in retrospect, of course she does.
Yeah. I mean, as she's, hopefully as she becomes more comfortable around Wallace, that will, and does seem to, you know, slip away. That's the part I love the most about this chapter is like, we hit the, you know, Lucy hyper aware of all these kind of unconscious or potentially conscious biases that people might have around her a lot at the start of the chapter. And then we get a genuine kind of connection from Wallace and his ability to relate later on that we'll get to through his, you know, chronic health conditions. And it's just like, oh yeah, this is just, I mean, it's not identical, obviously, but there's an overlap in experiences there, and it means that Lucy can kind of see Wallace as somewhat of a kindred spirit, and it's really nice.
it is. I mean, like, as you said, this chapter starts so heavily with Lucy, you know, yet again with the weight of the world on her shoulders, which is, you know, just normal for her at this point. And basically this whole chapter is her learning to, and through connecting with Wallace, being able to let all that go.
Mm.
Like, we almost skip over the whole second half of the date just because Lucy manages to put all this shit behind her and just be in the moment, which is, like, again, huge for her. Like, yeah, that's something she's been doing with this whole body story. And it's so nice to see her, yeah, reach that point on this date where she can just be in the moment and not have all the other shit going on weighing her down.
Mm. Yeah.
Takes the whole chapter to get there, but, like, God, it feels earned and it feels, like, good when it happens.
Mm. Yeah, it is nice, isn't it? So, yeah, the triple date heads to a burger place and Emerson reveals herself to just be the absolute worst.
Yeah, there's, like, a really fun group dynamic that gets set up here with, like, you can sort of see the role all six of them are taking. And Emerson's is just at the very bottom. Yeah, you know, like, she starts bitching about Melissa, and I was just like, Emerson, you're just as bad as Melissa, except you don't have a reason. You're just shit.
Yeah, I was not impressed with her nor Wallace by the end of this chapter.
Wait, but, Wallace?
Sorry, not Wallace.
Xavier,
was it?
Yes.
Sorry,
I remember these two because I know an Emerson and a Xavier in real life, but the Xavier is a woman and the Emerson is a man.
Mm.
So this particular couple has just been doing my head in because I keep, like, swapping them around in my head. So I feel like I've overcorrected now. I'm very aware of who both of them are and exactly what every line they say is because I've had to, like, overcorrect.
I found myself hating Emerson so much that I'm even a little surprised. Like, have we seen Emerson before? Have we got this impression of Emerson before? Because she just seems so terrible.
So I went to look this up, but Snowdrop's tiny fan, who people may know as becoming the bloody Kaya can of Pale.
Yeah,
how encyclopedic their knowledge is. I managed to answer this before I could even start. Emerson has had one major appearance before. She was one of the people who was being mean to Lucy in, like, the flashbacks when she was doing her implement ritual.
Right.
Like, so sort of some of the people who, like, you know, she had to confront and understand that her instincts were right, that they were shitty people.
Yeah. Good to see her again here then. Just get more of that.
So she's been in other scenes and she was mentioned in the app and stuff, but, like, that was probably her biggest major appearance
before. Right.
It was basically being somebody that Lucy had to overcome in the implement ritual.
Mm. Yeah, she's the worst. Although she does have the same fashion sense as Snowdrop. She mentions wanting a shirt that says Little Miss Sorted on it, which is exactly the kind of thing I could imagine Snow wearing.
That does sound like a Snowdrop t-shirt, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so she gets 1 point against
her. She gets
her,
one,
like,
point on
a million.
That. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I really like this, like, group dynamic of, like, obviously Lucy and Wallace are both, like, really good people throughout this whole date. And then Mia and Amadeus kind of sit in the middle and are just, like, there and sitting in for, like, the average person because Xavier and Emerson are being terrible. And you can almost see that it's like this sort of back and forth trying to control the balance of the group through Mia and Amadeus. Like, like, there's moments where Mia starts to get on board with Emerson's bullshit and you can feel the whole tone shift. And then Wallace will sort of come in and try to change the topic and Mia and Amadeus will move away from it. And then it's, like, good again.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, really fun sort of balance with two teams, one good, one evil. And then Mia and Amadeus in the middle just shifting the weight.
Yeah. Yeah. It's it is fun. I'm glad. Well, what happens next is the groups split up and we get the good ones in one group and the shitty ones in another. Maybe that's a little harsh to Amadeus, but, you know.
He's a few points below Mia.
Yeah, so I think Mia is at least actively cool, whereas Amadeus seems passively cool.
Yeah, it's the top three and the bottom three for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, so they head off to the theater, and Lucy and Wallace get a chance to talk, and it's fun. They're a solid couple.
Yeah, and because like this is the whole thing about this premise. I think we called it out last week as well. Like the group dynamic for a date is so obviously like anti Lucy in many ways. That like this is great because as the date goes on, they break up more and more, the group at large, which lets them have more alone time, which is just so clearly better in every way.
Yeah.
I love the moment when they get to the theater and they actually start connecting over like horror games and horror movies. I'm still baffled as to why Lucy would want to play horror games when that's just her life now. Like, I guess that's the same as like me playing The Sims. I don't know.
Yeah.
I would have assumed her life was checking whatever boxes. You would have assumed
she's over it.
Sorry?
You would have assumed she's over the horror experience.
Yeah, I just would have assumed whatever itch that's scratching for her mentally would have been covered by, like, her life. Like how she goes through a terrible nightmare in a bit, like with the spiders. And it's just like, how the fuck are you going from this to playing a horror game? What are you talking about? That spider dream would have left me catatonic for a week.
Yeah, but maybe it's different when the nightmares are, you know, fictional, right? Like, obviously fictionalized and not going to play into your life. Maybe that's fine.
I guess. I don't know. It just feels like if I went around town doing chores all day and then came home to play Animal Crossing. Like, I don't...
But have you done that exact thing?
No. If I have chores to do, I don't play Animal Crossing because I've already done that shit.
Because I almost certainly have, you know, like, play Animal Crossing in bed until 1 p.m. and then say, oh, wait, I've got to get up and do my real world chores. Yeah. Anyway, I don't know. I kind of worry I don't have that much to say about this date stuff on a high level. Like, I feel like we should be analytical and stuff, but the overwhelming feeling of this chapter is just like, this is so nice and Lucy really needs this and it's so good that she's gotten it. And like, she can't fully be just in her own skin, but this is the closest we've really seen, right? And it just seems so nice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, like absolutely. It's just a really nice chapter to have because it just kind of all works out in a very fulfilling way and then leaves us on what is frankly a cruel cliffhanger. But yeah, I don't know. It just feels like another, like we've talked about this a bunch recently with like, you know, Lucy and Paul, Avery and Pam. Like there's very much this sense of like wholeness and satisfaction we're getting out of a lot of this stuff just because these are character arcs that have been bubbling throughout the whole story. Like Lucy getting this ability to just have a nice night and leave the weight of the world off her shoulders for the night is something she's been struggling to do since arc one. Like that has been a theme of her story since the beginning, and we're finally sort of having all these moments where the characters are, you know, not like checking off the boxes, like it's not like, oh, she's fixed now, but like getting those moments of triumph and like, you know, it feels like a big step. And I like, you know, it's part of why it feels like we're heading into the end of the story, as well as like why it just feels so fulfilling, because we're watching all of these moments that have been plaguing them since the start of the story sort of finally click into place.
Yeah, and just like with all three of the trio, just like having normal teenager moments is just so nice in this story.
But like again, I think that ties in, like the things that were keeping them from those moments weren't just magical. It like Lucy didn't have that ability to give people a chance and actually focus on the date in arc one. Like if this had been arc one Lucy, she probably just would have yelled at Emerson and stormed off. Now she was able to just kind of shut Emerson down. And then also, even if she'd made it that far in arc one, I don't think she would have been able to just focus on Wallace and connect with him in the same way. Like it's that growth we're seeing that feels so good.
Yeah.
Although like that said, Verona still feels like the old one out to me in that. Like it still feels like we haven't quite dealt. Like true. Verona got a huge sense of closure with all her stuff with her dad and her mom a couple of arcs ago. But then, obviously, her whole stuff with her identity and her humanness is feeling more and more like the big thing that just has the potential to blow up and has me worried.
Yeah, I can see it. yeah, I don't know. I think we'll probably get a bit more of Ren and Jeremy before the story's over, and hopefully it doesn't go terribly.
Yeah, but it's not just a relationship with Jeremy. It's this whole, like, Half-Light business. Like,
true.
It all ties together to an extent. But, yeah, like, you know, we touched on it at the start of her last chapter with, like, her identity. Like, she kind of knows she isn't happy where she is, but she still doesn't have that clear picture of where she wants to go. Mm. And in an arc, like, called False Moves, I feel like that's a recipe for some valid concern.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Wait, something that's interesting, though, talking about the relationships, is something that, like, really crystallized for me as Lucy was having these thoughts here is relationships are a massive blind spot for the trio in terms of, like, their ability to communicate with each other.
Mm.
I think right from the very start of this podcast, we've constantly been amazed at, like, how these three have avoided, like, intra-group drama.
Hmm.
Just by talking shit out like adults, like whenever it seems like, ooh, this could cause drama, they just talk about it and it's fine.
Hmm.
But as like relationships become sort of more of a crystallized thing with, you know, Jeremy and with Wallace, it's like Verona clearly, you know, we talked about already, can't communicate exactly what she wants with the other two. Lucy feels guilty for different reasons talking to either of them about it. Avery, obviously, you know, that's been a very big thing for her this entire story. It's like it's the topic that I think more than anything else we've ever seen is something the three of them cannot get on each other's pages with. And I just wonder if that's going to actually be something that starts to cause problems. You know, not like a group breakup problem. Like, yeah. I don't think that's what Pale is. But, like, you know, it's going to be lots of, like Verona is starting to harbor a bit of resentment towards Lucy. And, like, you know, is that going to grow and turn into just something that, like, is a bit of a problem when it should matter or something?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, yeah, I don't know. I don't necessarily think that will happen, but I can see what you mean. Like, it does seem like, I mean, I guess it's, I don't know if it's ironic, the most teenage-y drama stuff is the stuff that's the most at risk of causing rifts in their trio.
Yeah, I guess, like, maybe the way I'm picturing it is less like, it would probably hurt the relationships themselves more than the relationship between the Kenneteers, if that makes sense. Like, you know, while Verona doesn't have people to talk to about this Jeremy situation, she's letting it drag out, which is, like, the thing that concerns me about it.
Mm.
Or, like, similarly, you know, Lucy not really being able to talk to anyone but Dr. Mona about this stuff kind of led to this date taking a while to get off the ground. It's so like this is the thing they don't have people to talk to about because they can't talk to each other, and usually it's always each other. So like that's what worries me is like, yeah, maybe it's less about forming a rift in the Kenneteers and it's more about like continuing to hurt their ability to end up in the relationships they want to be in because they can't talk it out freely with the other two.
Yeah, interesting. So yeah, we're at the trio's at the cinema, and as the movie starts, Lucy realizes it is Gabe's film, and this kind of leads to her getting kind of overwhelmed. So she and Wallace head outside to have a D&M instead.
It's so good. Like,
it's pretty messed up.
I was cackling when it was Gabe's movie.
Mm.
Like, because there was just so much going on, and Lucy was already starting to drown in the pressure, and that was just the icing on the cake. That just, yeah, like, when she first started to call attention to the movie, I was like, oh my god, like, is this some sort of racial thing? Like, that's the last thing we need. And then it was just Gabe, and I was like, okay, no, that's so tragic, it's funny. Yeah, I mean, I really love this moment. Like the moment where this whole situation really turns around is this bit where Wallace makes what I think we can all say is a pretty shitty joke.
Mm.
And she just, like, loses it. Like, it's that sort of emotional outburst where you just, because you've got other shit going on, you just laugh at a joke that...
You laugh so much harder than you should and you can't stop yourself.
Yeah, it's like what Verona did when Ray was questioning them in Arc 8. It's like, you know, when people start laughing at a funeral, like it's like misplaced emotion and it just sort of leaks out of her in this moment. Then Wallace kind of clearly gets something similar when he laughs at her shitty response.
Yeah.
And they just like kind of leave and actually connect. And it's like this really great moment.
Yeah, it is great, isn't it? And then they have this nice moment outside, and it's John who's looking over her, and that's nice because Alexander can't do shit, can't get anything right. That fuck.
I love it. That was my exact response to it. Like when John shows up and is like, you know, I'm going to be your guard dog, basically.
Yeah.
I was just immediately like, eat it, Alexander. Like,
yeah, exactly. Fuck you, Alexander. Your murder was justified.
Yeah, like you know, as we're ramping up to dealing with his death, it's absolutely like Wilbo's doing this on purpose, having John Sharp to be around Lucy.
Mm.
Like, it's absolutely sort of signaling, because he's going to be the one who's in the hot seat, presumably, like, alongside the Kenneteers, but, you know, he was the one who did the killing. He's the one the BHI is probably primarily going to be after.
Mm. Yeah. 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 It'll be interesting. We'll see, I suppose. That's not to worry about for this chapter, though. That's a future chapter problem. So, yeah. I also just want to call out this very smooth move by Lucy where Wallace says, Amadeus was saying I should take the lead. And Lucy's response is to, you know, give him a kiss me face and say how. Like, oh, Lucy. Such a good strategy. So smooth. I loved it.
Yeah, actually, she sort of thinks to herself in a sec after this, she's like, I mean, I did kind of cheat. Like,
yeah.
I overheard that conversation.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, it's pretty great.
Yeah.
On a less smooth note, can we talk about, like, just Avery's such a dork. She writes Lucy a little poem in this text message that I just wanted to call out because I was just like, oh, Avery, you're such, like, an adorable little dork.
Mm. She is, isn't she? Avery, you gotta love her. The date is over, and unfortunately Lucy has to go back to the real world, or the nightmare world, and the trio head to talk to the third conspirator, Charles, who immediately surrenders.
Again, just a reminder, this spider nightmare is horrifying. I don't know how Lucy can just be in a conversation immediately after it, but whatever. She's clearly braver than I am.
Yeah, it's all pretty messed up nightmare stuff.
It's just funny because, like, Verona's are so much more like it's her dad, or
yeah,
she's, you know, falling and kind of hits the ground, but she's able to just get up and
yeah,
move. Where and like even Lucy's ones in the past were like the thing with Booker. This is the first one that was just like a genuine nightmare. Like every time she touched the spider, more spiders started growing out of her skin. Like, it's fucked.
Mm.
So far and away, the scariest nightmare.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. So, we're finally at the point where we're going to get to hear Charles's side of the story and find out if he's basically guilty or not, and I'm very excited for it.
Yeah, and like again, we have the stage set for us. So much more than anyone else we visited, he's being like cruelly targeted by his nightmare. Like there's like broken glass glued in place to cut his feet if he tries to like relax on this chair or the table or anything. Like I just really love it. Like we sort of enter this scene and it's like, oh shit, it's Charles, and he seems to be being very upfront, but like, yeah, we just get these reminders from the scene that like the world is out to get him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I guess we'll see, right? I don't know, like a lot of people have their response to this scene is, well, remember, Charles can lie. And I'm kind of like, yeah, that's fair. And he could lie, and that would be, I guess, weird to deal with in this story, someone who can overtly lie. But also, the interesting thing is, Charles can't make deals. So he can lie, yes, but he can also just kind of tell the truth. Like,
yeah,
Edith was not able to be honest with the Kenneteers, even when she kind of wanted to, because she wasn't forsworn or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Charles, with Marcy and Edith effectively done out of the position to be able to threaten him, if there's anything about him being under duress, like there's no deal he could have possibly made that would prevent him from just coming holistically clean. So I don't know. It's going to be an interesting one.
I do think it's great that we're all kind of flummoxed by just the situation every character in every other story is in.
Yeah.
Which is just, he can say whatever the fuck he wants, and there's no universal punishment for it.
Yeah.
And we're all like, oh, but he can lie, and like fucking drawing pin boards out of, yeah, just how normal characters in stories are.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. Like, he can lie, but I mean, Nibble and Chloe actually brought this up in the previous chapter where they were like, yeah, you know, everyone has to tell the truth, but also we deceive each other all the time. And I'm kind of sick of doing that. So I'm just going to be upfront.
Mm.
And this sort of thing where like, yeah, Charles can lie, but he also doesn't need to. Like, yeah, I don't know. I almost feel like if he is lying, it's going to be like, it's going to be that inverse. So normally everyone else is telling the truth and the lies are hidden within the truth. I feel like he's going to kind of still be doing that because like the best lies have bits of the truth in them. So
yeah,
like he's going to be kind of telling lies by throwing in little bits of truth, which is like just what everyone gets to do anyway.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting and we'll have to kind of talk about it in the next episode, presumably.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Like,
I'm sure it's going to be a mind fuck because, yeah, for once we can't just count on him to tell the truth.
Yeah, we're going to have to look at every single sentence and be like, is there anything about this? I mean, it feels like we're going to be dealing with Marisica again, basically, like questioning every sentence. I don't know. It seems, but it feels like it'll be exhausting.
But then that's almost not the point because he doesn't have to watch his words.
Yeah, true.
It's like us watching his words is almost falling into the trap that
yeah.
we don't need to be falling into for this conversation.
I guess I mean just kind of looking for more traditional markers of deception. I don't know.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, yeah. Again, I just find it so fun that we're all so flummoxed by just
normal. How do we do this? How do we tell if somebody's lying? It seems impossible. He doesn't have to follow the rules now.
Yeah, yeah, but you're right. It's going to be much more like when we read any statement, it's going to be like, okay, if this is a lie, what would be the reason for him lying about it in this situation? Because he very much comes into this conversation with the energy of, yeah, I'm fucked, like, whatever, which could all be made up. Like you get so tinfoily with this because he's like, yeah, I did it. Technically, that could be a lie. Like, you know, we had everyone else more or less confess when they got caught. Like Marisica, not so, you know, directly because she's a fae. She confessed by fucking shit up and running away. but like, it'd just be a funny three beat for like Edith to be like, oh, fine, it was me. Or Edith's like, no, it wasn't me. And then it's like, okay, fine, it was me. Marisica kind of avoids them and then indirectly confirms it by running away. And then Charles is just immediately like, yep, it was me. And it turns out, actually, it wasn't. He's just
bullshitting.
Like, yeah, I don't know. Well, so my hope is still that what happened is he did this in a fit of rage after the Carmine, like, refused to see him. Or, like, maybe he did get a trial and he lost it and he was, like, so angry that he lost his appeal that he, yeah, I don't know, maybe he just did this and it was emotional and then when he went to undo it, he wasn't able to and Edith wouldn't let him. And then obviously Marisica came in and started running the show. I don't know. So the shred of hope I'm still holding on to for why Charles isn't a terrible person is because I think it would be consistent with what we saw of him in flashbacks for him to lash out and then be in a position where he couldn't undo it. He strikes me as someone who will get emotional, do something, and then not be in the position to...
To be able to... He'll regret it, basically. Yeah, I think that's a pretty hot fan theory at the moment as well.
Okay, cool.
We'll have to see how it goes next chapter, I suppose.
But before we do leave, I also have to say, Verona throws in a line right at the end of this chapter where she tells Avery to tell Snowdrop that if she's going to fake being Verona, she can't keep being that weird because it made Jasmine worry. We need the details on this so bad. I want to know what the fuck weird shit Snowdrop was up to. Snowdrop impersonating Verona is just the content I need in my life.
Yeah, it's it's pretty a juicy detail to get dropped, isn't it?
Well, especially because like Snowdrop still has to say the opposite of what she means. So like, I'm just picturing this like Snowdrop interlude of like her trying to be like Verona and so saying things she thinks Verona like would or would not say.
Yeah.
And just saying the weirdest shit.
Saying the opposite like, stuff, what? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, weird. I hope we get to flash back a bit and see that, because it will be delightful.
I mean, yeah, if we don't, which I'll be very sad, but also this is exactly the kind of thing that makes this world feel so rich. Like the fact that one throwaway line like this has us like all worked up like this is just a testament to how rich the story is.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I guess that's the end of our discussion on these chapters. But before we go, let's dive into some Pale predictions, predictions that people have left in our Pale Predictor form. Do you want to start us off, Elliot? Have you got a prediction that you liked?
Yeah, so I pulled out a prediction from Tsarwat, who basically predicts that John will still become Lucy's familiar. And basically the point Tsarwat's making is that Alexander did sever their bonds, but didn't fundamentally change the nature of the individuals who formed them in the first place. So basically, absent any further meddling, the two will be able to establish a new relationship and create a bit more of an honest friendship that will lead to, you know, a familiar relationship with, and the bold specific part of the prediction is that the epilogue will involve Lucy sitting next to a golden retriever with a large number of tags on its collar. I think that the reason that like I was willing to bring this in when I think we've had similar ones of how Alexander's stuff wouldn't work is I really like the spin on it being a new relationship. Like, because Alexander, I went back and read 7.x to confirm. He says that the relationship, the connection that he severed wouldn't renew. So I like this sort of, you know,
some evolved version of their relationship. Yeah, bullshit of
rather than it renewing, just a different one forming. Like, obviously, John and Lucy very much had this, like, protector, protectee. Like, John saw her as Yolda. So if they kind of find their way to maybe forming a more equitable relationship, it'll actually be an even better familiar bond. Like, so I could see this spin on it being a very differently balanced relationship, being a way that it still feels satisfying to me for them to end up together, despite getting that very concrete line in 7.x about them not getting renewed their relationship.
I like it. I do think there was a lot of finality to that when it originally happened, and so I don't think it would be satisfying if it's just and now they actually develop their same relationship again. But I like the idea that a new relationship and one that has some interesting differences that we dive into could kind of be a workaround, I guess.
Yeah, like that would be key to me for it to feel satisfying, as I feel like there'd have to be emphasis on how it's not the friendship they had before. It would have to feel different enough that I could be like, oh, okay, yeah, so this wasn't it renewing, this is something new for me. What have you brought for us?
I brought a prediction from Justin Sanak, and this prediction is quite an interesting one. They are saying that they think the last chapter of Pale will be published as close to September 22nd as the schedule allows, because that's the end of summer this year. They point to Arc 12 of Ward, and there's some minor spoilers there, but I won't go into it. Basically, the story having some kind of poetic significance to when the chapter publishing dates were. And obviously in Pale, we've been talking about the end of summer a lot, and, you know, we feel like we're maybe potentially a month or two away from the end of the story. It could quite line up that the story literally ends at the end of summer, and I just think that would be delightful.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, because it's like the end of summer in the context of this story, or like the deadline in this story, isn't it like the end of August or the end of July?
I mean, my interpretation of when American summer ends is not great as an Australian.
No, yeah, exactly. I'm just thinking, like, I thought the deadline for, well, you know, like half the shit in the story at this point, was closer to being sometime in like early August or mid or late July. God, now I have to go look it up. I feel like
Looking this up right now. Okay.
Don't get me wrong, Justin Sanak is right that the end of summer is like the end of September, but
meteorologically ends on August 31st. Then there's the kind of equinoxes, right? So the fall equinox is on the 22nd of September. So that's what Justin Sanak is talking about, that the equinox being the kind of marker between the seasons is on the 22nd. So that's kind of the the transition they're talking about, which I guess is the more, I don't know, the more witchy transition, I guess. So maybe that's the one the story will use. I don't know. Either would kind of work, I suppose.
I'm just thinking, in the story, I think they're in like mid-July or mid to late July, and they've got like a week and a half left or whatever. So like, yes, maybe it's even closer than we think. Maybe we're looking at like
the story
wrapping up in...
in 3 weeks.
Okay, never mind.
That seems unlikely, unless Charles is a real showdown. Yeah.
Well, yeah, Charles comes up and he's just like, hey...
it was me.
It was me. Here's how you beat Marisica.
Yep.
Here's how we fix everything.
Yep.
Go to the epilogue. That was 12.5.
Maybe there's only one chapter left. Maybe it'll be Charles says, yep, it was me. Here's how I did it. Take me away. And, you know, Lucy puts handcuffs on him. And that's the end of the story. And we never find out what happens with the Blue Heron Institute people that are coming back to town. That's for the sequel. Worry about that next time.
Well, no, they come and...
and they take Charles away. Yeah, exactly.
Charles' situation explained, and they're like, oh, yep, fair enough.
Fair enough, yep.
They go home. That all worked out. Witch hunters take Guillaume away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I do kind of just like the meta prediction nature of this one.
Yeah.
I think it's fun.
The idea of Pale ending at the end of summer, it feels very good.
Yeah.
I do hope it's not quite that late in September, because that means that our stream would probably have to be right around the same time as International Games Week.
Yep.
Which would be a nightmare.
Melbourne International Games Week is a big day in the calendar for us in the games industry. Although, you know, COVID stuff might completely fuck it up. So who knows?
Oh, that's true.
Maybe there'll be a silver lining. anywho.
God.
If you want to leave your prediction about this story and potentially have it featured on the show, you can find the link to do that in our show notes down below. Hey, also in the show notes down below, you can find our discussion thread link where you can leave your answer to our discussion question, which is currently ongoing.
Yes, that question is, what form would your wolf take? Or, you know, it doesn't have to be yours. It could be any character from a Wildbo work or whatever.
Mm.
Just as we started to get clarity on what the wolf is, I'm interested to hear what forms people think they'd take.
Yeah, you can leave your answers to that in our discussion thread, which will be linked down below.
Yes, don't forget to check out our Twitter, at Pale Reflections. Oh, no, at Pale Reflect Cast, I should say.
Oops, whoops.
That's where we do the live reads and we post other stuff, and check it out.
Yeah, other places to check out would be our website, doofmedia.com, which has all the details on the Pale Conflections fan art contest, the siblings fan art contest that we mentioned before, as well as all the other great shows on the Doof Media Network. If you're a fan of Dark Souls, actually, that's a bonus content episode. So
yes,
to find out about that, you will need to join the Patreon at patreon.com/doofmedia and join at the level which gives you access to all of our weekly bonus content shows.
There's obviously Freeman Bros, which Ruben alluded to, which was talking about game design.
Yep.
And there's been a lot of talk about that on the Discord. It's been very fun. There's also the High Ground. We'll be doing that in a bit.
Mm.
Another perk of the Patreon, actually, in a fortnight from when this is coming out, we're going to be doing that meet and greet with Malia and Jenny.
Yes.
So if you want to come hang out, do a bit of a Q&A with the two of them.
Mm.
You know, sign up to our Patreon.
Yeah, yeah. While you're on Patreon, why not head over to Wildbo's Patreon and support him? Because without his Patreon, Wildbo wouldn't be able to create all of these horrifying, terrible nightmares that we saw in these two chapters. So if you want more of them, like the sick bastards that you are, support Wildbo's Patreon.
And with that note, we'll see you next week for more False Moves.
Bye!